these budget gains are not working out. This week, administration has recommended an 8.7% tax increase for 2024, citing increasing cost pressures. And no, cutting bike lane funding won't fix that.
Plus, we dig into transit-oriented development, the nighttime economy, and bike lane infractions on 102 Avenue.
Hi, I'm Mac.
I'm Stephanie.
And we're
Speaking Municipally.
Welcome back to Speaking Municipally, episode 259. I think the first time in the history of this podcast, there's no Troy. Glad to have you with me, Stephanie.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm super happy to be back. Yeah, and lots of juicy stuff to talk about this week.
It's a good week for you to come back, for sure.
Yeah.
Probably with the two of us, fair to say there won't be as much conspiracy theory hatness going on. But yeah, we'll still do our best to live up to Troy's expectations for the podcast.
Yeah. Maybe we'll have a couple little moments of conspiracy thrown in there. We'll see what happens.
Could get crazy. But first, we want to tell you that Speaking Municipally is a publication of Taproot Edmonton. And this episode is brought to you by Estate Administration Week. This annual event is presented by the Edmonton Community Foundation to empower you to know what to do when you find yourself named the executor of a loved one's estate. It can feel daunting, but ECF is here to demystify it by sharing expertise through information sessions led by volunteer lawyers throughout the week of April 15th. The week culminates with a rousing game of Jeopardy! Estate Administration Edition, led by estate lawyers Michael Simons and Allison Barkwell on April 19th. All of the sessions are free, even the Jeopardy! One, and you can learn more about all of the things happening that week at ecfoundation.org/estatepower. That's ecfoundation.org/estatepower. You can, of course, also find all the sessions in the community category of the Taproot Edmonton calendar. We're fans of Jeopardy, Stephanie, so that
yes,
sounds like that would be pretty interesting. An interesting way, a more accessible way, perhaps, to get into maybe not the most favorite topic.
Yes, exactly.
Also, not the most favorite topic for most people, especially city councilors who will have to make a decision about this, mm-hmm, is increasing taxes. So we heard, yep, just today, actually, on Thursday, we're recording this April 11th, that administration has released its spring operating budget adjustment. What are they recommending?
Yes, they were recommending an 8.7% tax increase for 2024. So that's an additional 2.1% that was approved in November of 2023. And they're citing a couple reasons for this. They're saying they've encountered higher WCB premiums and a better understanding of longer-term labor costs. This tax increase, the city says, will also allow the city to deliver on these service increases that City Council has approved for 2024. So that's operating the new Metroline LRT to the new Nate Blatchford station and adding more bus service hours, expanding library service at Heritage Valley, and advancing the work on Edmonton's anti-racism strategy and truth and reconciliation.
All right. So some new services, which for the most part sound like things that Edmontonians want. We've been, mm-hmm, talking about the need to improve bus service, for example. Anti-racism and efforts along those lines have been a signature bit of work of this council. Perhaps not the most effective bit of signature work, but it is something they've been trying to undertake. But I don't know that those new services are really what is driving this proposed increase. And the CFO, Stacey Padbury, said in the news release that she said, quote, during the pandemic, the city kept tax increases below inflation to support Edmontonians, but now we need to catch up with rising costs. We've reached a point where we need to make choices between increasing taxes or reducing service levels to ensure that the city remains in its current fiscally sustainable position, end quote, which is, you know, a little bit amusing considering they had a deficit at the end of 2023. So fiscally sustainable, I suppose, depending on how you interpret that. Mm-hmm. What do you think about what she's saying here, that perhaps we shouldn't have had a 0% tax increase during the pandemic? Perhaps those weren't the worst rainy days and there was more to come.
So I actually was still in school, journalism school, when the pandemic started. So I wasn't a reporter and I definitely did not own property. So I don't know what it was like to pay property taxes during that time. I think like the worst of the inflation, like the highest inflation got was during mid-2022. So I think you're right that having these really low tax increases during the pandemic, I wonder if they're going to look back and really regret that because they kind of shot themselves in the foot for a few years by not having the taxes go up. And honestly, I remember personally, my finances were really good during the pandemic because there was government supports. There was the CERB. So yeah, I think that maybe council and administration will look back and regret the 0% tax increases during the pandemic because now you just have to catch up. And every year when there's that 6, 7, 8% tax increase, the people are not happy and they will not remember the 0% back in 2020. They will only remember the 8-ish now.
That's right. I mean, 8% is a big, big, or 8.7, almost 9% mm-hmm. is a big, big increase for 1 year. I think you're totally right. People have forgotten the zero already. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure it earned them any long-lasting goodwill. Just a little bit of context about how we got here, right? So in the four-year budget, the operating budget, the originally proposed increase for 2024 was 4.96%, which I think people already felt was relatively high mm-hmm. given those previous years of low increases. Last fall, administration did the fall budget adjustment and said, actually, we're going to need more than 7%. Council eventually knocked that down a little bit. They approved the 6.6, which you mentioned off the top. Mm-hmm. Now we're back with the spring adjustment and administration has gone even higher to say we need now 8.7%. And just as a comparison, I was looking at what Calgary has done. They also had a similar situation where they did an increase in the fall adjustment, but they went from 3.4% to 7.8%. Mm-hmm. So a much larger increase when they did their fall budget adjustment. I haven't seen what they're going to do this spring, but potentially because they made that large increase at that time, there's less need for them to go up again, unlike Edmonton, where we seem to have done this, you know, step increase over the last couple of adjustments.
Yeah. And this is just proposed. It's not fully set in stone yet. And like what happened during the fall adjustment, it started at just over 7, got moved to 6.6. Council will, I'm assuming, make a few cuts during the spring operating budget adjustment and try to rein it in. They do have the documents available on the city website where you can see like what service packages and what potential projects they could be cutting or funding. They just came out and I haven't had a chance to take a look at them, but this is, it's sort of the culmination of the OP12 work that we talk about often on the podcast. And yeah, so I'm assuming the number will not be as high in the end, but
I suspect taxpayers are hoping you're right, although yes. Some early reaction to these numbers make me wonder if that won't be the case. So we heard from Councillor Michael Jans, who's been kind of beating this drum for a while now. He's written an op-ed and has published a number of things about this. He says Edmontonians are not receiving a fair deal from the provincial government. He's talking about how the UCP government has made reductions and they're not funding the city of Edmonton or indeed other municipalities fairly, in his opinion. And if they reversed those reductions, then perhaps our taxes, property taxes, could be 7% lower, which is quite a big change. And he's, of course, using the $60 million that he's written about before in the op-ed as sort of the foundation for that, but a whole bunch of other things as well, where municipalities like Edmonton, but across the province, have been frustrated with changes that the province has made and how they are not indeed paying their tax bills.
Mm-hmm. And then Public Interest Alberta, the leader there, Bradley LaFortune, put out a statement on this, on provincial property taxes and whatnot. And the statement was rather brief. It was simply, quote, pay your taxes. Clear where he stands.
A man of few words in this case. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess there's nothing else to say. If you feel like the reason this budget adjustment is as high as it is, 8.7%, is because the province isn't pulling their weight and providing their fair share, then what more needs to be said other than pay your taxes on this?
Mm-hmm.
Of course, one other thing we've seen right away, and we always see immediately after we talk about any kind of tax increase or anything related to the budget, is bike lanes. Don't read the comments, but if you read the comments, people will say, well, of course, taxes growing up, we're spending $100 million on bike lanes. I'm sure you've seen this, Stephanie, all over the internet.
Absolutely. Yes, definitely.
Can you think of what's wrong with that statement?
Well, first of all, the bike lanes come from the capital budget. Isn't that correct?
That's absolutely right. Yeah. So we should. This is why you're so good at Jeopardy. I mean, these are different budgets. Normal people don't know that and probably don't need to know that. Mm-hmm. But even still, if you look in the capital budget, it's on page 694. So way far down there. There's a table that talks about what they call the incremental impact on operating budget over the 4 years. And from bike lanes, that project, the $100 million active transportation implementation project, it's $1.9 million over the 4 years. Mm-hmm. That's not a very big number. It's not going to make a material impact on the budget. It's not going to bring that tax increase down any significant amount at all. But it's a political thing that keeps coming up and probably will continue to come up.
Yeah, all the time. And of course, a big part of the operating budget is going to be maintaining all the roads that cars drive on and that take people, you know, in and out of the suburbs and all around the city. But those are fine, according to many people, and they are fine. We need roads, but roads compared to bike lanes, it's like a drop in the bucket when you compare the two.
Yeah, roads and pipes, that's what some people think cities should do, and we do spend quite a bit on roads and pipes and not very much on some of these other things. Something we do spend an awful lot on, which I noticed was conspicuously absent from the news release, is police. The single largest part of our operating budget, and there's no mention of it in here. There's very few mentions of it in the report, actually. I took a quick gander at that. Of course, you know, they're talking about inflation. They're talking about unexpectedly large WCB bills and things like that. We also have salary settlements for the police, for CSU 52. I think somewhere in the news release, it says that the city has budgeted appropriately, but costs are rising faster. And I think cynically, you look at that and wonder, I don't know if they actually budgeted for all of these salary increases appropriately.
Isn't that kind of hypocritical to say we budgeted properly, but costs are rising? It's like, I don't think you budgeted very well then.
Yeah, exactly. Well, as you said, this is not approved. Council will get its first chance to discuss it on April 23rd and 24th. And then, of course, the bylaws to set the tax rates, which will be based on whatever the approved tax increase is, come on April 30th. Then the city will, of course, mail out notices, and your property taxes, regardless of what council does here, will still be due on June 30th. So that story is developing, and I'm sure we'll have more to say about the budget in the weeks ahead. But something that is published already and has been underway in Edmonton for a long time is transit-oriented development. And Stephanie, you did some reporting this week about how perhaps Edmonton hasn't been as successful at this as we hoped or should be.
Yeah. I want to frame the story in a way. So just close your eyes and imagine for a moment an LRT stop being built in a neighborhood. And you'd think, oh, there's an LRT stop. Let's all move there so we can be next to the LRT. Well, there are some neighborhoods in Edmonton where zero new people moved to live beside the LRT in the years that it was being built. So that's how I want to frame it. I spoke to Jacob DeWong, who is a data scientist and a co-organizer of Grow Together Edmonton, who I think Taproot has spoken to before. I don't know if it's been on the podcast, but they were at the zoning bylaw renewal public hearings, kind of advocating to allow more dense housing. They kind of organized in opposition to the very well-organized anti-density folks in Edmonton. He analyzed an 800-meter radius around 48 current and future LRT stations. So that's all the existing ones, plus the ones along the future West Valley Line LRT. And he found that around some of the stations, population has not grown at all. And then he also looked at district planning, which, as I'm sure our listeners know, it's kind of like upcoming city planning policy that's meant to guide density. And he looked to see what the overlapping plans were. So when you look at a transit or the LRT station, does it fall into a node and corridor? And he found that a lot of stations didn't fall into it at all, which means that basically, they're not encouraging any denser than 8 units per lot, which he says, no, we need to do more. So yeah, that's kind of the gist of it.
So why does that matter? Why is it a potential problem for Edmonton that population residential density is not increasing around transit stations?
Well, I think what Jacob was saying is that it's part of the city plan to have 50% of people move in through infill, and that is going to be hard to do if every single person is still completely relying on driving a car to meet their daily needs. The other plans are, I think 50% of trips are taken by active transportation and by transit. Again, that's going to be hard if people aren't living next to easily accessible transit, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's a big part of how we're going to continue to house and support all of the people that continue to move to Edmonton. And your story is that 100,000 people have moved to Edmonton since between 2016 and 2021. Another 100,000 are expected in the next 3 years. Like,
no, 100,000 since 2021. So in the past like 2 years, 100,000 people.
Ah, sorry. Yeah. Fastest growing between 2016 and 2021. 100,000 in 2 years, another 100,000 in the next 3 years. Okay.
It's so even more. Yeah.
Really fast growth. So those folks need somewhere to go. Exactly. And they also need to get around the city to get to work or school or what have you.
Yeah. Part of the reason why we published it when we published it is that the Prime Minister's office announced that to access a public transit fund that they're planning to introduce in the 2024 federal budget, municipalities must, quote, take action that will directly unlock housing supply. So those actions include allowing high density housing within 800 meters of high frequency transit lines and post-secondary institutions. So about half of the stops only have a small amount of overlap, meaning these district plans, they don't explicitly encourage dense housing in the radius around the stop. And what Jacob wants is he wants the city to consider putting in like a TOD, a transit-oriented development overlay, so that in this 800 meter, boom, immediately you're allowed to have high density housing. He didn't directly connect it to this funding, but he just thinks that it's important to be encouraging density around these billion-dollar investments. He had a comical quote. He said, you have to remember that these are billion-dollar investments that we're putting into the LRT line. It's not someone's personal LRT line to take downtown. We should really be making the best use of these investments as possible. And yeah, if zero people moved to an area while the LRT was being built, that's like very boggling to me. And it's kind of a failure. I don't know if I want to go that far, but it's just kind of brutal to look at that and be like, we have this big, amazing city building LRT that's coming. And then you look at what's actually been built and it's next to some stops. It's absolutely nothing. It's kind of depressing.
Well, I would say maybe an alternate take is that it's not surprising for two reasons that come to mind. I wonder if you talk to Jacob at all about this. So one is the oldest LRT stations in Edmonton along the Capital Line were not really designed with TOD in mind. That wasn't a thing when we built most of the stations along that line. It's high floor. It's not low floor LRT. Right. You know, the stations are not generally located in residential areas. You know, even the South Extension that we eventually built, I think there was plans and a vision for housing to develop and spring up around Century Park. And that hasn't also fully happened. There's been some there, but perhaps not as much as people were thinking. Possibly that's because even as we've built out this LRT, we've kept it pretty car oriented. Mm-hmm. Century Park was not a place to live for a lot of folks in the South. It was a place to drive to and park your car so that you could get downtown. And then I wonder about this, the Southeast LRT was just too new. You know, like Bonnie Doon, for example, there are plans to redevelop the mall and build some housing there. But I mean, the LRT itself has only been open a short period of time. Perhaps it's just too new. One of the stations you focused on in the story was Avonmore. Tell us a little bit more about that one in particular.
Avonmore is one of the new stations on the Valley Line Southeast LRT line. And in between 2016 and 2021, so that's like when it was being built, 0% population growth and also 0% new dwellings. So they knew this was coming. It was being built and no one was thinking I should build in this area. And so then looking forward to the district plans, there's very little overlap for the nodes and corridors. So primary corridor is where like the most density, major node, that's where the most density is going to be encouraged. And then it kind of goes down from there. So secondary nodes and corridors, less density. So there's just one major road that kind of runs near the Avonmore stop. Along this secondary corridor, you're allowed to have housing in these draft plans up to 4 stories tall and up to 8 stories tall along these larger roads that run through this portion of the land. But only 10% of the land around the Avonmore stop is classified as a secondary corridor. The rest of it is just zoned like a normal neighborhood. That's your residential small scale zone, which allows 3 stories tall and 8 units per lot. So again, not very high density. And that's, you know, within a 800 meters, that's going to be about like a 15-minute walk to the station. And we're basically still only allowing like small apartment buildings at the absolute most in most of this area. So yeah, not really aligned with the city plan, I would say.
Yeah, and as you point out, we've known about the route, at least for the LRT mm-hmm. line, for a lot longer than the train has actually been in operation. Mm-hmm. In theory, people could have been, developers could have been looking at that to build something. It's possible that zoning bylaw renewal was seen as a precursor, and so mm-hmm. why would we go and do this extra work? Let's do the zoning bylaw first. But also, what this suggests is that developers haven't been clamoring for a redevelopment around or rezoning around these stations to mm-hmm. change the density, as you've just outlined. So that's perhaps a little bit concerning. Mm-hmm. The only bright spot I kind of gathered from the story is Clairview, actually.
Yeah.
Clairview's increased.
Yeah, Clairview has seen a lot. So in the last 20 years, their population went up 170%, which is a lot. I actually wrote, my friend lives out there, and I rode the train to go see her, and she lives in one of these like kind of condo-ish buildings around there. And it's like a nice little area, you know, like nice little apartments, like some fun little walkways, a nice little courtyard in the middle. And it's nice. And I can see why people would live over there because it's quite connected. I mean, it's still pretty car centric. There's like a big superstore there, but she walks to get her groceries and stuff. So big population increase over by Clairview.
I probably should just get out there. I haven't been out to Clairview in quite a while, but in my head, it's still very much a very big freeway car place. You've got Fort Road and the, you know, the road going out to the Anthony Henday, and you've got 137th Avenue, which is this major east-west corridor, big box stores and things like that. But great to hear that there's increased housing out there. And of course, the Clairview Rec Center and other city facilities out there have been pretty popular.
Mm-hmm. You still have to walk through like a 700 car parking lot to get anywhere, but it could be worse. It could be nothing there, I guess.
Well, we could just do it better from the outset. And this was a discussion, of course, with the Valley Line West and Lewis Farms. We're building this train, we're building a rec center, we're building all these things at the same time. Why don't we make them closer together and actually make it transit oriented? That would be a positive thing. And if we did that, if you didn't have to walk through a large parking lot, maybe more people would want to live there. Mm-hmm. Well, I do live near an LRT stop, near many LRT stops, actually. I live right downtown, of course, on 102nd Avenue. And 102nd Avenue was in the news again. CBC had done some interesting reporting where they set up a camera, recorded a 48-hour time lapse of the intersection at 102 Avenue and 100th Street, so just a few blocks away from both of us, Stephanie. Mm-hmm. And they found a lot of infractions in that time.
Yeah. So over the 48 hours, they found 381 infractions. So about half of those, I guess, 178 were people, drivers, blocking the crosswalk or the bike box. There was 89 drivers that drove in the bike lane. I watched the video and there was at least one that went the wrong way and then turned around and drove down the bike lane. So kind of two for two there.
Yeah.
And yeah, you can see the full list of numbers on, and it's just this one intersection that they happened to catch on their camera. So yeah, lots of people misusing, and it was on Thursday, February 29th to Saturday, March 2nd. So you kind of get the weekday and the weekend traffic. So that's a good, sample, I would say.
So probably the infractions would have been a lot higher if they had just done weekday when there's, you know, more, more traffic, both pedestrian, cycling, and vehicular traffic, I would imagine, depending on what's happening in Churchill Square or around the downtown.
Right.
Councillor Ann Stevenson was quoted in the story and said, there could be a bit of an adjustment period as people are learning how to use the corridor correctly. What is she talking about? This didn't just open. Am I not getting this, Stephanie?
Yeah, I'm not sure. Again, I wasn't a reporter. I've only been like a full-time reporter here for like a few years, but I'm pretty sure this road has been designed this way for like 3 or 4 years, hasn't it?
It's been a while. Yeah. I don't mean to be particularly hard on Councillor Stevenson. I heard her second part here is the part that is more interesting. She said that the data collected, quote, certainly raises questions about some of the design elements. This is what this boils down to, right? I don't think that education or a certain amount of time to adjust is what's needed. If you've ever closed a street, if you've ever tried to block traffic in this city, no matter where it is, for whatever purpose, you will very quickly realize that drivers will do absolutely anything to ignore those signs. It says road closed, there's a barricade, no problem. I've seen drivers get out and move those things to try to get through them. Not knowing obviously what's on the other side and what kind of trouble they might run into. So I don't think we're going to change the behavior of drivers with education. And clearly temporary things are not going to work. The only design element that we've seen along the 102 Avenue bike lane around this area that the city has attempted are those flex bollards. And I was so excited when they installed those things because I was walking by there every day and I could see all of the kinds of things that CBC has captured on this footage. And I thought, well, this is great. Finally, they're going to do something. But it was maybe a week, 2 weeks, and those flex bollards were all gone. So it is really designed down to design. When you look in the summertime, the bike lane and the traffic lane look pretty similar. And there's no physical barricade. There's no physical bollard in the middle of the bike lane. So cars turn into that all the time, and then they never get out of it. And in the wintertime, because of the number of vehicles that end up driving down the bike lane, they also look very similar, unless the bike lane has recently been cleared, because you get the ruts from the tires and stuff on the two. And so it looks like two lanes. I don't think it's that complicated, Stephanie. Some actual real bollards. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've ever seen that account on Twitter, but there's the World Bollard account is the best thing ever. If we had those, people would stop driving down the bike lane.
Yeah. Well, they say that they take the bollards down to help with snow clearing. But I don't know. We put a man on the moon. I think we can figure out how to clear the snow around bollards. People, I'm sure they have bollards in Scandinavia and it snows there, or in Montreal, it snows there. They can figure it out.
Yeah, I feel like this is a solvable problem. Mm-hmm. Maybe we just need to be more creative. What if there was spikes that came up depending on the weight that is on top, right? Then if you're a big F-150 and you try to drive over that, there go your tires. You're not going to turn into a bike lane ever again. If that happens, right?
But then the truck would be stuck there and it'd be blocking it for longer. No, I'm just joking.
I mean, that happens already anyway. Yeah. I think trucks park in the bike lane all the time.
Yeah.
Anyway, a little frustrating to mm-hmm. see this, but interesting to maybe raise the discussion about whether it's just bad driving or if it's also poor design. And I think it really does mm-hmm. come down to design. The way you design something is what will encourage or nudge the behavior that you're looking for. And personal opinion here, I don't think it's that much of a hot take. I don't think the 102 bike lane downtown has been designed to nudge drivers to avoid the bike lane.
One last thing that I want to say about this article that I thought was very interesting is that injuries and fatalities in Edmonton due to vehicle collision had been going down. In 2010, there was about 6 per 1,000 population, and that's went all the way down to 2020. It was under 2 per 1,000 people, but now it's back up to 4.42. So that's the highest that it's been since 2013. An interesting reversal of the trend. You know, we get like the Vision Zero. We get a lot of hype for being a Vision Zero city, but this is something interesting that all of a sudden the big jump was from 2021, where it was just around 2 again, up to 2022, the most recent year for which data is available. It's back up to 4.42. Interesting thing to keep an eye on. Like, why are we all of a sudden having more injuries and fatalities? And it's not just a pandemic thing, because it's way higher than it was before the pandemic. So I don't know, just something to keep an eye on.
I mean, very concerning, especially when those collision numbers include pedestrians and cyclists who mm-hmm. are much less likely to survive a collision with a motor vehicle.
Yes.
Something else to keep an eye on here is what might happen to Edmonton's nighttime economy. So mm-hmm. this report came out a couple of weeks ago, or maybe last week, and council mm-hmm. got a chance to discuss it, or committee got a chance to discuss it this week. I'm talking, of course, about the thriving nighttime economy and the proposed strategy there.
Mm-hmm. So the proposed strategy, they got the study done by Explore Edmonton and UK-based Nighttime Economy Solutions, and they recommended that Edmonton establish a night mayor and a nighttime economy alliance. Also, nightmare always makes me laugh because it sounds like, nightmare. Anyways, so they want to, or they call it a nighttime economy lead, so we'll use that so people don't get confused.
Sure.
They recommend, those are the two kind of main things, is that, okay, we got to do the night economy lead and the night economy alliance, and they want to start kind of tracking how many businesses do we have open after 5 p.m., how many people are coming to these businesses, kind of getting that baseline data collection so that they can kind of set goals moving forward.
Why is the question? Is this mm-hmm. A big need? Is there, what is the reason we want to have this thriving nighttime economy?
This came from a council recommendation. I'm not exactly from who and when. It's been a couple of years though. And I think, I know a lot of cities around the world do have a night economy lead to, kind of advocate for the night economy, because it's important. It's important to be, I think, in a world-class city, it's important to have like a good nightlife and to make sure that your downtown is not just completely dead after the hours of 9 to 5 on Monday to Friday.
And you of course have businesses that operate primarily in the evening. So bars and restaurants and things like that. And I can understand the need to want to find a way to support those businesses a little bit better, both with the sort of data metric tracking and sort of strategic stuff, but also safety, right? I mean, I think when you think about nighttime, it's dark, it's harder to get around. Safety is a big thing.
Yeah, there's this article from CBC that I thought was interesting because all the people that are quoted in the article focus a lot on police presence. But in the actual report, police are only mentioned a couple of times. And the only recommendation that I saw was that they consider adding a couple cops in high foot traffic and high crime areas. Panita McBrien said something interesting. She said that since COVID, the nighttime beat police presence has gone down a lot from her observation.
I did think that comment was really interesting too. I mean, the DBA, I think it's fair to say, has been pretty supportive of increasing police presence, and for them to have noticed that perhaps that hasn't been happening at night, I thought was pretty interesting. You know, we just talked a little bit about design and design elements and what that can do for a problem you're trying to solve. And I think that applies here too. Like having a couple more beat officers is fine, but there are only a couple of officers. They can't be present all over the downtown. They're not going to make that much of a difference. You know, to me, the two things that might have a better return on our investment both relate to design. So one is the number of people that are actually there. If you have more people living there, if you allow for more housing and other developments, more eyes on the street, I think makes you feel safer than you are when it's pretty empty. But the other would be lighting and all of those kinds of things. And so I thought it was interesting. We haven't talked about it in this episode, but you know, the next round of funds for the Downtown Vibrancy Fund are now available and applications are being accepted. And one of the things in there that I thought was interesting was about street lighting and decor and that kind of thing, trying to, you know, boost the visibility of things downtown, I think could be a way to help address some of those safety concerns for the nighttime economy.
For sure. I think an important thing to bring up when it comes to this nighttime economy trying to fix safety is that this like visible police presence, it's pretty clear what they're targeting. They're targeting people on the streets, like running around with a knife, like that kind of vibe of like random violence.
Yeah.
But when you look at what is statistically likely to happen, like I am way more likely to be like, I, as like a 25-year-old woman that visits nighttime establishments, I'm way more likely to be like assaulted or hurt or harmed by a man that is legally enjoying the drinks at the bar. I'm more likely to be harmed by a man that I know, a friend. That's just what the statistics say. I'm more likely to be like assaulted by someone in the bar than someone that's outside. Maybe someone that's visibly using drugs or someone that's having a mental health crisis outside. So something that I thought was interesting in the report that was made by Explore Edmonton was, here's a couple quotes. So visible policing can bring many benefits to the experience of safety in a city at night, from the perception of safety to the deterrence of potential criminal behavior. So like I said, like that sketchy kind of random violence. However, it is essential to consider the perspective of minority populations when planning to bolster police presence. And then later on, it goes on to say, yes, police are good, but in particular, groups focusing on drug and alcohol harm, vulnerability, and violence against women and girls should be introduced into Edmonton's nighttime spaces, whether in the form of pop-up triages or signposting to online resources and contact information. Because the average person, the average woman is way more likely to be harmed by like a group of dudes just legally enjoying the bar, not like a sketchy person on the street. It was nice to see that included, that to kind of have like that reality check of who is actually most likely to harm and be harmed.
I think that's a really important point. And in the CBC article that you mentioned, they spoke to Rob Prowatsky, who's the co-owner of Evolution Wonder Lounge. And he said the same thing. He said, quote, people are really quick to scapegoat that onto Edmonton's unhoused population. He's referring to the fact that downtown seems a lot less safe than it used to be. He says, I get that, but that's not where we're seeing most of the safety issues. I think people forgot how to be people during COVID.
Yeah. It's one of those core things that this alliance is never going to fix. You can't fix patriarchy through the Night Economy Alliance. You can't. This alliance is not going to make women stop being sexually assaulted at bars. Some of the people quoted in the CBC article did say, like, why are we expecting this to fix like society's problems around nighttime safety? The report's recommendations, they are a lot more simple than that. Some of the recommendations are to, elect a night economy lead, create a night economy alliance, hold some monthly meetings, maybe an annual conference, make an awareness campaign like, hey, we have a nightmare now. Collect that data and then make a citywide culture and creativity master plan. So it's I think that the recommendations are pretty realistic.
We might extrapolate that having this nighttime strategy could do all of these amazing things for those major systemic issues that you talked about, but we're not going to start there. We're going to start with a nightmare, which lots of other places have, except we're not actually going to start there because committee basically just received this for information this week. Mm-hmm. In the report, it said that if we did want to pursue this, we need a budget, we need a funding source. I think it was going to be $200,000 a year to pay for this night economy lead. And council gave no direction about that so far. But this is going to come back again in a couple of weeks when they talk about the spring operating budget adjustment. It looks like there's an unfunded service package for Explore Edmonton, and this is part of that service package. So remains to be seen what council decides to do on this.
Yes.
We're talking about bars and restaurants at nighttime. Very quickly, we wanted to talk about one other thing that Troy and I noticed a story about a couple of weeks ago and didn't have a chance to talk about. But you did a little bit of investigation into. So this is Hudson's on White Avenue.
Yes.
Popular restaurant there in Old Strathcona. And they've been having some issues with their patio.
Yes. So as I'm sure anyone who's driven up Gateway Boulevard can remember, they've been tearing up that corner, Gateway and 82nd Ave. And that's Hudson's right there is on the southwest corner. They've been widening the sidewalk to like improve the pedestrian realm and whatnot. So for the last couple of years, they've had a lot of problems with the patio, which is like a very popular patio, they say. Lots of people go out and check it out. And now they're having issues because it's all done. And they thought, great, we can open up our patio. It's going to be awesome. It's a new, nice, widened sidewalk. But now they're hearing from the city. Like when you walk down White and you have to walk around the patios on like the kind of boardwalk things.
Yeah.
They're everywhere, right?
Yeah.
But now they're saying that the patio has to be right next to the road and pedestrians have to be able to walk next to the building. And that's because someone at City Hall told me that the reason why that is because it's now this new sidewalk that has new requirements that have kind of like updated accessibility, updated pedestrian first priorities. So now instead of shuffling the pedestrians basically onto the road, they want to keep the pedestrians on the sidewalk. Now, of course, people are now sitting basically in the road if the patio goes out to the road. That's obviously not ideal either. And you don't really want to be sitting and eating directly next to, exhaust pipes and stuff, but you also don't really want to be walking there. It's a bit of a mind-numbing bureaucratic thing to me. It's just like, why can't we have anything nice?
I mean, in other places, they've figured this out. They have patios on sidewalks. They don't require a great deal of infrastructure in order to make those things happen, or at least it seems like it requires less than it does here in Edmonton. I've had this experience downtown, of course, with different patios. I'm thinking of Darinku on Jasper Avenue, between 103rd and 104th. They had the same situation where, the patio was on the sidewalk. You had to go around it as a pedestrian on the street, which means you have to have these little ramps that go down because the sidewalk is not flush to the road, obviously. It's raised up quite a bit, so it's a big accessibility issue. If you're sitting on the patio, you're on Jasper Avenue. That part of Jasper Avenue has a lot of traffic, a lot of cars. It's not the most pleasant place to sit. And to me, it was an illustration of how it kind of comes down to investment into that patio. Because you've further down Jasper, you've got Rocky Mountain Ice House, which has a much bigger patio. The railing and the boardwalk where pedestrians go is much nicer. You do kind of go off around it, but you don't have to go down or anything like that onto the road. Like, it seems like it was implemented in a much better way, which I assume means they invested more money into it. I don't know if Hudson's is reluctant to invest what's required or what the issue is, but it feels, like you said, kind of bureaucratic, and there should be a way to make this happen.
I know. No one's arguing that we shouldn't have sidewalk patios. They're awesome. I will probably be at one this weekend, if I'm being real. But like, it does, it just seems like just such a silly thing. They did used to have a very well, like, established one similar to the Rocky Mountain Ice House one, where yeah. they had like kind of a roof and stuff, but they had to take it down when they tore up the sidewalk. And now they're just kind of stuck. They don't really know what to do next so that they can put it up. They're not really sure. And my city hall source told me that this is getting worked out. They're working on a solution. Do not fret, but it is just kind of silly. Also, it makes me think, you know, with the upcoming Old Strathcona Public Realm strategy, how they want to widen the sidewalks all along. So is it going to be now every patio on white is going to be like at risk of this change? Because that's kind of how it seems to me, is that all of these patios are going to have to figure out if they want to be close to the road or not. They might have to close. That would be not good, I don't think.
No, I imagine we would hear lots of upset business owners if that was the case.
Yeah.
All right, well, more to come on that. Mm-hmm. And only one more thing to come in this episode. Even though Troy's not here, mm-hmm. we're going to do the rapid fire. Yep. I think, Stephanie, in the history of this podcast, I maybe have written one joke. Maybe, I don't know, not very many. Troy is the person who usually writes the rapid fire. But you have crafted
yes.
some excellent items for us to Thank discuss you. Today.
Okay.
So, on to the rapid fire.
Red Tape Production Minister Dale Nally was outraged to see 4-liter jugs of vodka on sale for $50 at a South Edmonton liquor store. Not because there was anything illegal about them, but because, quote, the vibes are heinous and I don't like them. In other news, traffic was snarled in Mill Woods over the weekend due to an unexpected influx of university students flocking to the area.
Old Strathcona arts institutions have started a new campaign, rallying hard to keep the farmers market parking lot as a parking lot. They want arts audiences to write to their counselor saying the White Avenue area, known to be a hub for creative minds and social change, should keep the status quo, and that any attempts to improve anything in any way will be opposed.
Edmontonians took in an underwhelming, partial solar eclipse on Monday. Mayor Amarjeet Sohi held an impromptu press conference blaming the province, saying since the UCP came into power, municipal solar eclipse coverage has decreased by more than 64%.
Did you watch the solar eclipse, Stephanie?
I didn't have the glasses, so I didn't feel like blinding myself, but I have so much FOMO and watching the videos of other people watching it that genuinely I'm planning a trip to go to the next one. It's in, I think it happens a few days after my 28th birthday in Iceland. So I'm like, yeah, that sounds like a fun trip.
Iceland yeah. is beautiful. That could be an excellent yeah. idea.
Did you take it in at all?
I looked out the window and it looked sunny still. So, you know, in Edmonton, we didn't have much of an eclipse, yeah. but I did see some of the stuff on YouTube.
Yes.
From Mazatlan in Mexico, and it was mm-hmm. kind of interesting to see. But, yeah. you know, I already feel like we're an insignificant speck in the universe, so I don't know if I needed the eclipse to remind me.
Yeah.
Regardless, we have to pay for this insignificant speck of a podcast, and so I'll tell you one more thing. We are part of Taproot Edmonton, of course. You can get all of the latest headlines and happenings and things like that from across the Edmonton region by reading The Pulse. It's our weekday newsletter. It comes out every morning. You can read Stephanie's great work mm-hmm. and everyone else on our team, and you can get it for free into your inbox. And you can find The Pulse and everything else that we do and publish, including this podcast, at edmonton.taproot.news. Well, Stephanie, we did it.
Mm-hmm.
No Troy, but we have an episode.
Yes.
Hopefully you enjoyed listening to this.
Yes, and hopefully everyone's not too sick of me jumping into guest co-host yet.
Oh, no. We're glad to have you. You'll come back again in the near future, I'm sure.
I would love to.
And probably we'll have Troy back next week. Until then, I'm Mac.
I'm Stephanie.
And we're
Speaking Municipally.